to the Archive Room podcast. First of May, I'm Judith Leigh, and I'm very pleased to find you waiting for me at the door to the Archive Room, the place where we keep stories of island life in years gone by, told by the people who were there. So come on in, sit down and make yourself comfortable, and let's listen to this week's selection. We're on the move in the Archive Room tonight with stories from the shelf marked motoring and a look at the TT races, but from a very different point of view. So let's begin in Marown. The year is 1985 and David Collister is in the Marown Motor Museum on the main road at Glenvine, chatting with the curator about a few of the collection of vintage and veteran cars on display there.
A lot of people love to look at these old vehicles, even people who aren't interested in the mechanical side of cars and so on. What is it that you think attracts people to old vehicles?
I think nostalgia. We have discovered here in the museum that it's very much a nostalgia business, that as people are dying off, so the interest is getting newer. People tend to remember either what they saw as children or what their fathers had, and that's the interesting era that they're interested in.
We'll start here with what seems to be an extremely eccentric vehicle that doesn't seem to make up its mind which way it's going.
No, this is a very odd one. Starting at the turn of the century, this machine was produced 1901 to 1903, name of Sunbeam Mabley. Two wheels in the middle and one each end. Both ends steer, one goes one way and one goes the other, and you pull the tiller left to go right and vice versa, which is interesting. 20 miles an hour flat out.
It must be one of the oldest exhibits you have, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah. We start about that period and then we gradually work up through. Come down the row, you'll see there's an Oldsmobile, 1903 Oldsmobile, the first of the mass-produced cars. About 20,000 were made in America.
Well, let's have a look at some of the more unusual vehicles that you have here. Now, this little bubble car is a classic Isle of Man invention, is it?
Yes, you're coming up to the other end of the scale now. You're coming up to the 60s. About the only car made in the Isle of Man, as far as we know, by the Peel Engineering Company. They made one or two special-bodied cars and one or two special one-offs, but the main production runs were the P50, which was single-seater, and the Trident, which was two-seater. They made 50 of each.
So this is a two-seater, but it looks as if it's going to seat two very small people.
Yes, you want to be very friendly with the person you're sitting with. There's not a lot of room.
No, and yet you would think that there'd be opportunities for a car of this size today, thinking of the Sinclair semi-bike or whatever it is. I mean, it's strange in a way that this kind of bubble car hasn't continued on into regular use.
Yes, it's true. It was the smallest vehicle ever made, and at that stage there were quite a lot of bubble cars, but they were all bigger. Of course, one of the problems is that people are more sophisticated these days and they expect reasonable silence and reasonable comfort, which is difficult to get in a small vehicle.
Now, just a little further on here is a contraption that looks to me rather like a sort of child's toy. Could you describe it for us?
Yes, well, it does give the impression of a child's toy, but it wasn't. It was produced in large numbers. It consists of a number of flat lengths of wood, about 2 inches wide and about 7 foot long, which are all connected together with lumps of steel at each end. And on each corner of the steel are wheels, cycle-size wheels. But the power is provided by a fifth wheel at the back, a motorised wheel, a wheel which contains the engine actually inside it.
This is quite extraordinary, isn't it, really? But not a lot of power.
No, not a lot. It'll run along the flat. The slides tell it won't climb.
It seats two people, but they'd have to be fairly tiny to get in there, wouldn't they?
And fairly lightweight.
Yes. But it's in beautiful condition. Where did you get this from?
We obtained it as a load of bits about 20 years ago in London, and we rebuilt it. There's no gearbox. You simply drop the wheel on the ground to go, and if you want to stop, you lift the wheel off the ground.
Now, alongside it, or just behind here, the classic Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost.
Well, it's the classic. It's the one that Rolls made their name on. They've traded on that ever since. For its time, it was particularly quiet and particularly reliable. A very big car, a heavy car, but the great advantage is you can still get parts, and nearly all the parts are still made.
Now, this superb snake head here, or serpent's head that I see just over the front wheel, that is what?
That's the horn, for the bulb horn, the squeeze-type air horn, because the electric horns of the day weren't that reliable. Although it has an electric horn, they always backed it up with an air horn, and you could have any sort of mouthpiece you liked. Most of them were plain, but the serpent's head was an option.
Mm. This is the car that was in the television series, was it?
That's right, Upstairs, Downstairs, and the follow-on Thomas and Sarah, and various odd films, etc. Sort of thing you can let somebody have, and it's fairly rough heavy, it can't do much harm to it.
Moving on down the museum now to take a look at some of the other cars here. Do you have a personal favourite?
Yes, I think the electric car, because it's unusual, it's reasonably cheap to run, a 1916 Detroit. It's fairly slow, about 20 miles an hour, but that doesn't matter much over here, and its range is perfectly adequate for the Isle of Man.
It's got huge batteries here. How many batteries does it have, in fact?
It's got 80 cells, which is 40 each end. It's quite a substantial size batteries. The batteries alone weigh about a ton.
I bet you can't get those batteries from stock.
No, they had to be specially made by Chloride in England, who very kindly did that for us.
Now, you take it on the road, then?
Oh, yes. It's licensed, and we use that. If we want to go anywhere, that's the car we use. We don't use a modern car, we use that thing.
Well, it's certainly in superb condition, isn't it?
Yes, it's quite good. We were lucky. We didn't have to do a lot to it. We found it virtually in that condition.
This is the reason, I suppose, why there are no or very few electric cars around, because of this battery problem.
Yes. In the Isle of Man, where you only want to go a short distance, it's all right, but their range is about 30 miles. They claim 50 to 80, but you're very lucky to get that on any one.
And you'll only get, what, about 30 on this one?
Yes, about 30. If you're on a very flat road, you get 40, 45, but it's got to be absolutely dead flat. Next to it, we've got a Stanley steam car, one of the few steam cars still in running order, 1904. Well, it's fired by non-leaded petrol. So everybody says that the petrol companies killed the steam. This is rubbish, because the amount of petrol they use is colossal. 5 miles to the gallon if you're lucky, with a gallon to make fuel.
Here's one that looks to me as if it ought to be pulled by a couple of horses.
Yes, you're quite right. It is a cart virtually without the horses. Again, American. It's exactly as though the horses had been thrown away, an engine been put underneath. A flat air-cooled engine, like a Volkswagen, only much bigger, twin-cylinder, and big cart wheels with solid rubber tyres. Strangely enough, it's very comfortable.
What's this handle here? Is it a handle?
Yes, side-winding handle. You don't wind it from the front, you wind it from the side, and you turn it backwards, which is a bit tricky to get used to.
Is it in running order?
Oh, yes, it is. It runs along quite nicely, again about 20 miles an hour, but it has 2-speed gearbox, but you can't change it on the move. Whichever gear you start off in, you've got to stop
it. I guess it would take a bit of power to turn that handle, would it? Or?
Yes, it does. You want your big hefty man to come along and wind it up for you. And if it stops, you go and find another hefty man.
The wheels are brilliant. Are these new wheels that you've had made, or the original?
No, the original, just carefully cleaned up. They're varnished spokes. It's just a case of scraping and scraping away at the old paintwork to get up white, get the wood white.
The old solid tyres. Beautifully made.
Made by International Harvester, the people who make combines today.
Well, let's have a look at a final one now. I'm looking at something that I would perhaps call the Batmobile of the exhibition.
Yes, most of the stuff we've talked about has been early, because it's most of the early cars, the interesting ones. But here is a very odd modern car. It's made on a McLaren racing chassis by a General Motors designer in the mid-60s, bodied by Angels and Williams in London, who are the racing car body people. A very peculiar glass-covered front supercar or modern futuristic vehicle.
21st century.
Very much so, and it must have been very way advanced in the 1960s when it was made. They were going to make 10, but they ended up only making this one.
I'm not surprised, really.
Nor am I. Impossible thing.
David Collister, back in 1985, exploring the fascinating collection of cars in the Maroun Motor Museum. Cars were also one of the subjects when David chatted with Alfred Duggan. Alfie was born in 1912 and was in his early 90s when he reflected on his time operating a taxi business and could even remember all the details of the very first car he owned.
The first car I had was MN5994, and it was a 1927 Armstrong Siddeley.
Whoa.
And it was bought from John Somers Christian, Point Hotel, Port St. Mary.
Yeah.
The next car, I headed in the finish for a taxi.
When you were taxi driving then, do you remember taking any well-known or famous people in your vehicles?
I drove Nigel Mansell, Formula One driver. Nigel Mansell was over the Derby Castle terminus, and he had driven a horse tram from the terminus, Derby Castle, to the Victoria Pier, and I met him with a Daimler, a white Daimler car, a big seven-seater. The number of that car was 1DMN, and just took me around to the town hall, signed the mayor's book, and also his good lady, Roseanne, was with him.
Going back a bit, when we used to have entertainers here, stars coming to the shows and that sort of thing, do you remember any of them?
Oh, I had lots, yes. For instance now, Ken Dodd, the Doddy man, used to call him. I think I was his chauffeur. Every time he came along to the Isle of Man, he had an awful lot of luggage. He always went to the Villa Marina. And there, he used to go with a nice young lady called Anita, but sad to say, she'd passed on.
Oh, yeah.
He was a type of person who was very kind in nature. He would give you a present and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, all right.
And I think I've still got one of his dusters.
Tickling sticks.
Yes, that's right. Yes, Kendall was very nice, and I used to always like driving him.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, I never charged him going to the airport. He's always got the airport. He's so nice, you know, really. Elsie Tanner. I drove Miss Phoenix in 1964.
Yeah.
And she was with a girlfriend.
Pat Phoenix, that was, wasn't it?
Pat Phoenix, that's yeah. right, on Coronation Street.
Yeah.
And also, I think there was two gentlemen. One was Mike, and the other was Ken. It could have yeah. been Ken Baller and Mike yeah. Baldwin. And the other lady could have been Deidre. Yeah. But I took them to the airport, and I told them a little history about the island, yeah. going over the ferry bridge. I said, you've got to raise your hat. If you're wearing a hat, I said, the man, you've got to raise the hat and say good morning, good afternoon, little people. And then got to the airport, and... Pat, give me a card that's a photograph, 1964. I still got that card, photograph of her, and it says on it, with love, Pat. Pat Phoenix. Mm-hmm. The Palace Hotel, too. I drove many of the fellas, really. Tom Jones, that gentleman.
Yeah.
I drove Tom Jones the Palace. He was going to the airport. I remember I had a brand new Zodiac. Number was 226, man. And I got outside the Palace. Seen Tom Jones coming through the door, went to press the button, nothing there, just a tick. And it was brand new,
And it wouldn't start.
It was summertime, and I got two or three lads who was passing by. Yeah. I said, do you mind giving us a push? He said, it only went to a few feet, and the way she went.
Yeah.
But Tom Jones noticed it, and he said, but I've seen what happened. I know what's up with the car, he said. He said, it's the Bendix spring that's gone. He said, I've got one identical to that.
Yes.
So the Bendix spring it was. Many, many groups we used to get to.
Yeah.
Dave Clark Five and the Seekers and Malcolm and Wise.
Malcolm and Wise?
Yes, we had them. We used to meet the Gaiety Theatre.
Yeah.
We used to meet them, two-car job, that.
Yes.
Eddie and myself used to go there.
Uh-huh.
Malcolm and Wise. And if there's any groups, for instance, at the Castle Mourne Hotel, and it was a special group, you get lots of fans there. Eddie and myself would go over to the Castle Mourne. Aidan will go down the side place, the back of the Castle Mourne.
Yeah.
I'd be outside the Castle Mourne waiting, as he thought, for the group.
Yes.
The fans out there waiting, but I knew very well.
You get them at the back.
But Aidan would get them at the back, and then we would come up round the back side. All of a sudden, they'd see the car going up through the back, and they'd be booing in and shaking their fist. They'd miss the group. It was great fun, really, isn't it?
Alfred Duggan reflecting there in conversation with David Collister about his time operating a taxi business. He also ran a school of motoring, a car hire business and a funeral director's that still bears his name. Now let's move along the shelves to the TT Races archive. Not to talk about riders, bikes or even lap records, but to get an insight into how Manx Radio actually began broadcasting race commentaries. It all began in the year 1965, and in this conversation, David Collister is joined by Charlie Webster, Manx Radio's senior producer, and Jeff Cannell, legendary TT race commentator.
TT, the Tourist Trophy. We better start with Charlie because you actually go back right to the time when Peter Neal had started his commentaries on Manx Radio in 65.
First TT, 65. We weren't allowed into the grandstand. We were completely barred by the BBC and the ACU. And we weren't allowed in the grandstand, so we borrowed the large green commentary box, which was used a Timmel in those days, double-decker. And we put that alongside the cemetery. And we were in there. Stuart Lord did the commentary from Ballacrane. And there was an awful commentary position. He was in the pub. And he said to me, how would I know when the riders were coming? I said, well, watch the BBC chap pick his lip mic up. And when he picks his up, they're on their way. And then we had a van, I think, at Balaf on the forecourt of the garage on the left-hand side there, which is another awful commentary position. You couldn't see anything. And then we had Ian Cannell up at the bungalow, highest point on the course.
You were engineering.
I put all the equipment out.
What else did you have to do during the course of the race itself, then?
Well, he just had to be on hand in case anything went wrong, in case the transmitters would go off at Foxdale, which, I mean, they weren't 100% reliable in those days. Go out in the morning, first thing, about 6:30, go up to the bungalow. Years and years ago then, I mean, senior race day, there was hundreds of people walking up Pilbury. So you had to put the equipment in there, and then you'd go down through Salty Will then to Balaff.
So presumably, from the broadcast point of view, the programme was controlled by the main presenter, Peter Neal.
Peter Neal. Yes, he was the anchor.
So everybody picked up their cues from him?
Yes.
Jeff, you started, I think you had told me, as a timekeeper then, did you?
Yes, I went out to Ballacrane, by which time they'd had a proper commentary box put up there on scaffolding. That was all right there. It was a bit difficult to get into the box, though. You had to get up on a wall and then sort of across the top of a hedge and leap in through the back of it. And that was 1968 timekeeping for Jack Cretney. And 68, 69 and 70, which were the 3 years I did at Ballacrane timekeeping, were fantastically hot. So hot that it was 100 degrees in the box, and you had to have the back door closed because there were speakers outside which would feed back.
Yeah.
And you just couldn't do your mental arithmetic on the times because it was so hot. As soon as you opened the door and the air came in, you could go back to normal service. So I did that, and then in 1970, the last race was the senior, and there'd been, I think, a 1:25 race in the morning, and Jack's voice went, and they rang from the grandstand and said, give Jeff a go, because I'd already, of course, done the 69 Manx Grand Prix at the bungalow, so they knew I could do the stuff, but to be chucked into the senior race was a thrill for me. But I got through, and one thing I do remember is that Agostini was winning, and he came round Ballacrane and the machine coughed a bit, and I said, sounds like one of the carburetors is a bit out of adjustment. And I was very pleased when he said at the end, well, I wasn't able to go quite as quick as normal because one of the carburetors was out of adjustment.
You had to be a motorcyclist to know that.
You did, yeah.
What were the toilet facilities at these commentary positions around the course? And presumably at Ballacrane you could get into the pub, could you?
Well, you could. Or the people that had the private house nearby were very kind of Manx Radio. And in fact, they fed and watered them.
Who were the other commentators in the early days?
Ken Lees.
Yeah.
And Ian Cannell.
Ian Cannell.
Well, of course, Ian was with it for a long time,
He was with Colburn's, of course, wasn't he?
Well, Colburn's actually put a pretty good system out to start with, long before Manx Radio, and it was very comprehensive. They had about 10 commentary points. They were all over the show.
Yeah.
And, of course, you'd have the BBC doing it as well. David Lay, you know, and Bertie Reid and people like that. But it was very Ken Wolstenholme, very precise, and here he comes
but it
now.
But it was only intermittent, wasn't it? It wasn't a continuous commentary, I don't think.
Well, Colburn's was, I think.
I think it was Colburn's.
Was it?
Yeah.
Round the course commentary.
Yeah.
It was very, very far before
and
its
that
time.
Was used by John Grierson for the very first coverage that Manx Radio had. It's the only way they could cover it in 1964.
Yeah, they came to an arrangement with Coley and picked up his feed, I suppose. Yeah. People like Dolan Kelly were out at Sulby.
It wasn't very good commentary, because I remember being at Fox and Lanes at the time, and we just got a new big stereo radiogram, and this chap would come on and say, in the lead is number 17, followed by number 16 and number 32.
Yeah, and you wouldn't know who they were. They didn't have a programme.
That must have been one of the difficulties for commentators, because there's not a lot of time between looking to see which number 37 is.
Well, once you get used to it, you don't need to, of course.
No.
You know them by sight. But the Manx Grand Prix is different. You need to look at the programme, but it is an art which you can do by averting your gaze, same as when you're doing anything else on a microphone you can read at the same time. But one of the problems, of course, in those days was that the fast riders weren't always at the front. Nowadays, the fast men are all in the top 30 riders.
Mm.
But then they used to be spread throughout the field, so you could have number 2 leading the race and number 99 running second, and of course there wasn't enough time on air at the points to get them all through. So the whole thing was always running full nuclear, you know, and but it was all right for the time with what equipment there was and what knowledge there was.
You also had the situation as a commentator where they'd hand over to you and expecting a certain rider to come through, and he hadn't appeared, and you had to fill out and pad out.
Jeff was a master of that.
Yes.
Well, anybody can talk when there's lots of things happening. The trick is to fill in and try and make it sound interesting. You can't have dead air, and at Balaff Bridge with a Formula 3 race, it would be 8 minutes before the riders got to the bungalow. Well, there'd only be 20 riders in it, so they'd long gone through Balaff, the last one of those, and we never quite got round to describing the seagull flying around, but it wasn't far off at times.
About the laugh, I mean, George Leeming, the landlord of the pub, we eventually moved into the pub upstairs in the lounge.
Yeah,
it was in his own lounge, which is very kind of him, really. And when there were postponements, of course, you were lying around for hours out there in his living room. And then, of course, he would start up on the electric organ downstairs, which gave a novel twist to the commentary. And he would have the horse racing on full blast on the television as well.
Did we pick that up on air as well?
Well, you could hear it in the background.
In the background,
it was all part of the fun of it. I used to actually give the horse racing results out. just to fill in. But you couldn't see that much because it was a great view of the bikes coming down to Balaf. They jumped the bridge and then you didn't know what happened to them. Well, if anybody's going to crash at Balaf, it's after they've taken the bridge. Mm. But you couldn't see what had happened to them. You just had to wait and see if the marshals were running.
There were wonderful days, though, weren't they, in the 60s and 70s?
Well, I was at Balaf for 17 years, of course. I mean, I did Ballacraine with Jack for the 70 senior. Then I moved to the bungalow for the Manx and did the Manx a couple of years, 3 years up there, I think. And then when Ken Leash packed in, I went to Balaf and made that my home for 17 years. And yeah, it was the best place on the course. Always exciting.
I mean, there must have been some really hairy times where things went wrong. You see, the listeners don't hear the things that go wrong in the background, do they?
No, well, one of the things that went wrong badly one time was that there was a postponement, and it was so long a postponement that I went home from the grandstand and they said, the next announcement will be at 1:30, the roads will close at 2 and the race will start at 2:30. So about 1:15 I set off for the grandstand, got to St Ninian's and found the road shut. They'd advanced the race by 30 minutes, which was totally illegal because the announcements on Manx Radio carried the full force of a road-closing statutory order. Anyway, they let me across, and I had the hair then all the way up Ingebrek and down Druidale to get to Balaf. The race had started as I was still going down Druidale. Anyway, I screeched to a halt in the Glen Road at Balaf, ran across, jumped into the box, and they said, now to Jeff Cannell, and the bikes were coming down the road. That was tight.
Had you been able to listen to the commentary in your car?
Yes, I had.
That's
fortunate. That made it worse. You knew then how near they were getting to Balaf. They were certainly through Ballacraine while I was still driving down the road at the end of Druidale. Another time, I rode in the classic parade in the morning and then I had to get to Balaf for the race and I didn't allow myself enough time and I was still dressed in full racing leathers, driving a mini pickup at about 70 down Druidale to get there. And I hadn't had anything to eat, and I said on the air, you know, I haven't had a time for lunch. And the ladies from the Methodist Church, who ran a sort of thriving business selling teas and that in the hall nearby, came round. But the trouble was, they came round to the back of the box, and they were hammering on the back door of the commentary box, and we were live on air, and I had my foot against the door, and she was stood outside with sausage and chips and jelly. So eventually, anyway, we dragged this lot in and managed to devour that.
That's an interesting thing, though, Charlie. I mean, these commentators were stuck there all day, weren't they?
Oh, yes.
What happened? Did they get lunch? Did they get drinks? Did they get lunch?
In your own sandwiches in your flask. If you didn't take it for yourself, you've had it, mate. There's no toilet facilities at the bungalow. I mean, you know, you just had it.
Yeah, at Balaf, you actually had to cross the river, which reminds me of an incredible thing. When computers first came out, Charles Gard produced this computer and he said you don't need stopwatches and all that, you can time the riders by a computer, all preset. So he turns up with this thing about 20 feet square and hundreds of yards of cable and said, where's the power plug? Well, there wasn't one. So he had to put Wellingtons on and feed a great cable under Balaf Bridge and right through to Mr Mundell's house across the road.
Oh, wonderful stories these are.
When you look back, we were pioneers, really, weren't we, in the 60s?
Well, actually, it held the race together because it's so important to know who's leading it. Mm. And in the old days, you would send a car around at the end of the race to people who'd finished first, second and third, their numbers written on the back bumper of the road's open car. Mm. That was the only real way people knew who'd won. Then came Colburn's, then the BBC, then Manx Radio, but of course Manx Radio was able to do amateur timekeeping, which was very, very good. The O'Hanlon boys were absolutely spot on to the second. And now, of course, it's all done automatically by transponders. But it was a great way of keeping people informed. And, of course, all the people signalling the riders as to how they were doing all totally depended on Manx Radio.
Behind the scenes at the TT races, Manx Radio's senior producer Charles Webster and TT race commentator Jeff Cannell giving David Collister an insight into how they pioneered coverage of the TT races on Manx Radio. And I'm afraid that's all that we have time for this week, but there'll be another collection of memories and fascinating and funny stories to share with you when we meet at the archive room door at the same time next week. And as it'll be the last in the present series, I thought we'd finish on a holiday theme. So bring along your sun hat and we'll take a stroll along the prom, visit a few hotels and maybe have time to pop in to Cunningham's camp. But for now, let's turn off the lights and close the door. I'm Judith Leigh, saying thank you for listening and wishing you a very good evening. The Nation Station.